Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Black Wolves, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us for our talk this evening. We are delighted to be joined by Professor Danny Dorling, who will be discussing his fascinating new book, A Better Politics. Which is just that. Danny Dorling is the Halford Mackinder Professor of Geography at the School of Geography and Environment here at the University of Oxford. He specialises in issues of housing, health, employment, education and poverty, and has written an array of best-selling books around those subjects, including Injustice, All That Is Solid, Inequality and the 1%, and of course tonight's book in focus, A Better Politics. A Better Politics, How the Government Can Make Us Happier, focuses on what the government could be doing to create policies that work towards a greater well-being and better health, and not taking the approach of focusing on wealth maximisation. We all know at times that policies the government have in place can feel frustrating or restricting, which can affect our daily emotions and the way we live. A Better Politics focuses on basic needs, safety, love, esteem and education, exploring how new policies can make a real difference to our future generations. If new policies can make us happier in our daily lives, then this reflects on each other and the ways we work as a whole in the long term. A Better Politics explores that the government can and should work to make us happier. Therefore, I am sure we are set for a really interesting talk this evening. Please join me in giving a very warm welcome to Danny Dorling. Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming. I'm going to keep my glasses on this evening because I've got quite a lot of things that I'm going to have to read various bits about. What I'm interested in trying to do is to have a bit of a debate with you. So I'll try and keep what I say to just half an hour, which leaves us plenty of time to discuss things. And the way I want to try and get to the debate is I want to move on to how you might get the things that are proposed in this book, rather than the idea about whether the things in this book are a good idea. They're slightly motherhood and apple pie. On the back of the book, it's endorsed by people like Kate Barker, who's on the Monetary Policy Committee, Peter Bottomley, who's a Conservative MP, Tony Giddens, who used to run the LSE, Jeff Mulgan, who was, I think, in the Number 10 Policy Unit, and Andrew Oswald, who's a very nice Professor of Economics. This isn't an extreme left-wing, hippie, bohemian book. I don't think. It's somewhat toned down. I've got a little leaflet here, so if people don't want to lose some money, but want to still find out about it, you can take the leaflet. The aim of the book was to inspire a better politics, one that would enable future generations to be happier. So it's about happiness and well-being. Greater well-being and better health should be the goals. And I'll try and explain why, because I didn't just say that because it sounds nice. There's a reason for it. Rather than wealth maximisation, and again, there's a reason for this. We need to value healthcare more than hedge funds, caring above careers, relationships more than real estate. The book looks at the evidence for successful politics that will promote health and happiness and suggests politics that take account of this evidence that government can and should work to make us happier. Now, it did this in two ways. The first way is that I looked at some research I did 10 years ago with my friend Demetrius Ballas, whom the book is dedicated to, where we looked at a survey of people in Britain called the British Household Panel Survey, where for 4 years they were asked what had happened to them in a year, what had happened to them of significance to them or their family at the end of the survey, and they could write in anything. And halfway through the survey they were asked a question about their level of happiness. It was a very English question. So when it asked, all things considered, are you less than reasonably happy, or more than reasonably happy? And what Demetrius and I looked at is what is correlated with making you more or less than reasonably happy. And then the second thing, and probably much more important than our obscure paper, was I looked at a lot of work from recent economists published since we did that paper, which tends to suggest that people are not superficially, but fundamentally happier in better organised societies. Their level of mental illness is lower. They're likely to be calmer about the future in societies which are what I would call better organised. Better organised means good schools, rather than not spending much in your schools, a decent health service and so on. And the book puts the evidence together to suggest that it makes a lot of sense to want a society where good health and well-being is valued above becoming richer. I'll just give you a few examples, but the examples, I suppose, it almost bore me now. So we can have an argument later about, you know, is this correct? But there's so much coming out that it is boring. The Office of National Statistics produced a study last year looking at the Wealth and Assets Survey that found that people actually get used to having high housing wealth. They get used to having pensions for those who've got them. I won't ask you to identify which of you have got high housing wealth and high pensions. But for those of you who don't have a house or a mortgage or don't have a pension, and might well be thinking, this would be great, I'd love to get it. If and when you get it, you discount it actually quite quickly. What does make people happy is being able to save a small amount every month. Just having access to some money. And it makes you very, very miserable not having access to any. And there is enormous variation in the country between what people have. Households Below Average Income survey last year showed that close to a majority of children in Britain did not have a summer holiday that didn't involve staying with their granny or another relative. Because, and the parents were asked, because they couldn't afford one. That's half the population of children in the country not having a holiday. It doesn't take much to afford a holiday. You basically need to be able to save £10 or £20 a month and borrow a tent from somebody. Or get out the coupon in the Sun that lets you get the special cheap offers in the caravan park on the south coast. But you can't do that if you can't save. Now, I suppose I'll move on rather quickly from this evidence of what is terrible. But my starting point, and you're an Oxford audience, and you're likely to be politically similar to me, so I don't think I have to convince you that it's really, really bad when you're poor. And when you have a lot, you actually accept having a lot quite quickly, and it doesn't make you much happier. When we looked at what made people most likely to say that they were less than reasonably happy, the single most important thing was you just split up from somebody in the last year. Now, splitting up is bad for you, at least bad for one of you. Whereas the single thing that made people happier was starting a new relationship, which I assume make both people in the relationships happier. But after splitting up, the things that made people most unhappy were all related to health and were so frequent that they actually became the dominant factor in the survey. After splitting up from your partner, the thing that is most likely to make you most unhappy in your lives, and it'll happen to some of you already, is when one of your parents dies. Now, they're all going to die. I mean, you want your parents to die before you die. You know, that's kind of bad news. But whatever it is, we deal and arrange our society in such a bad way that parents dying makes us less happy. And then, and you can look in the book if you want to see the table, it's fairly depressing. The health of your parents, the health of yourself, death, other deaths amongst the family, which are very rare, are the major things that cause unhappiness. And so the kind of things that the book suggests is that if health is so important to us, you know, if health didn't really matter, you know, if we kind of go through life accepting, you know, occasionally we get ill and die and cancer's just something that happens. But given that health is so correlated to our well-being, why are we spending the least in Europe per head on our health service? Isn't that a bit stupid? I mean, somebody has to spend the least. It's a slight exaggeration. We were spending the least in Western Europe until the last couple of years, when Greece, under extreme austerity, reduced its spending per head to a fraction below what we spend on the NHS. Our NHS is very, very good. It's incredibly efficient. But we spend half what they spend on Switzerland on it. We spend about 50% less than they spend on Germany. And this isn't because they've got more money in Switzerland and Germany. It's because they choose to spend less on other things, and they choose to tax the population more to have a better health service. We could leave Europe tomorrow and put all that money, which isn't very much, that we pay net into Europe, into the health service, and it would hardly dent, because it's such a small amount of money. the amount of money we do not put into our health service because we have an attitude that says that health isn't that important. I can make it more personal, which I will. When I was growing up in this city, there were just 8 intensive care beds in the Radcliffe. And if intensive therapy unit beds, what you go into after intensive care when you're still critical and likely to die. If you were the 9th person to be hit in a car accident in the county of Oxfordshire and the 8th bed was full, there wasn't anywhere for you to be. And it's a choice. There is no private A&E. There still isn't. We have come to be a country that makes a choice that says, stiff upper lip, this kind of thing isn't terribly important. We'll fund it less than other places do. But when you look at what makes people unhappy, people really get unhappy about their own illness, but particularly illnesses of other people around them. And so I'm afraid the book is a bit depressing after chapter 1, because chapter 2 is all about death and illness. But I'm afraid that is it for well-being. And as you get older, you begin to appreciate it. In fact, it gets the happiness curve. The happiness curve is you tend to be quite happy when you're young. It goes down and down and down. I'm afraid about age 46 is the worst. I'm 48, so it's great news. So I'm on the way up. 90-year-olds are wonderfully happy. They don't complain about themselves anymore. They're just glad to be around. And this is from the survey. But, you know, as you get old, actually waking up every morning and finding everything works is a blessing. And these things differ by age. The book looks at 34 things that happen to people, the 34 most common things that happen to you in life, of which the least common is passing a driving test, which tends to make people happy when they do it. There actually might be, you know, not a particularly good thing to do when you're young. And then looks at the government policies that could influence those things. Now, most of them are actually about human relationships. They are about splitting up with somebody or starting a new relationship. And we are very good at splitting up. We have one of the highest divorce rates in the rich world. How can government affect your rate of splitting up? Well, splitting up is related to stress. If you have a more stressful economy, if you have one in which you're more likely to lose your job, have to start a new job, if you have an economy based around longer commutes, all of that is more likely to make it more stressful to be together. There are all kinds of ways I think government can influence policy. I use a whole series of geographical examples of how they do things differently in other countries, because this isn't kind of fantasy politics. This is actual politics going on now. In the Netherlands, half the population walk and cycle to work. They didn't used to. They've arranged things so that it's possible. It was a set of parents in the 1970s who were particularly angered by the rate of children being injured on the roads that began it. When you've got half the population walking and cycling to work, it basically means you haven't got a very long commute, which means you're around. You can even get more excited about the endorphins going up. I mean, sitting in a car on the A40, heading back home to Whitney, where you're so lucky to live, in that queue, if any of you've done it, exercising one muscle on your foot as you stop and start, and you get fatter. The stuff in the news today about how we're the fattest people in Europe, and you might have seen all the debate about the kind of food we should be eating or not eating today. We all seem to have forgotten the spirit level correlation from 2009 over why do people get fatter in certain countries. So that's quarter an hour, and I promised to only talk for 30 minutes. So you've got an idea what the book's about. It goes on about jobs and education and so on, but you can guess. So the question is, how do you get towards it? Now, today, the report Labour's Future, Why Labour Lost in 2015 and How It Can Win Again was published. And any of you can download the report. It was produced by an independent inquiry. And the independent inquiry was chaired by John Crudders. Does anybody know who was on the inquiry? Nope. It was his friends Nick and Jonathan. There were 3 of them. So if any of you are ever thinking of setting up an inquiry, you only need 3 people, and you can call yourself independent. And It said Labour must be economically radical but fiscally prudent. Labour can't win unless it looks like it's fiscally sensible. Identity and belonging drive politics. Labour must stop patronising socially conservative UKIP voters. Labour is becoming an exclusive brand where principles such as equality, sustainability and social justice matter, which is losing the connection with a large number of voters. But remember, this is just three people. All men. Yeah, I'm all male as well, I'm afraid. But I can, to make my life more exciting as I head towards my 50s, I'm thinking of going less binary, but that I'm saving that up for fun. So I want to talk about politics. And Labour and the Greens are the obvious party that might actually do this. Although you never know in politics. You never know what might happen. They have a table showing how bad local election results were a few weeks ago, where Corbyn won 33% of the vote. It's actually better than Blair did in 2004 and 2006. And Blair wasn't doing that badly in, well, apart from a war, that badly in 2004, 2006. The Conservatives got 32% of the vote in local elections. That is the lowest they've got at any time since 1981, after a leader's been elected, apart from the year before John Smith became leader in 93 and Tony Blair in 1995. So the Tories did appallingly. But this is presented as evidence that Labour can never win again. And it's just amazing how people do this. You know, bunging a table of any figures, nobody's going to look. So I looked. Here's the problem with Labour in 2015. Their main message was end slow austerity, the NHS and fairness. So that apparently was a bad thing to say, and that's the reason they didn't do too well. Whereas the Conservatives, and I can show you the graphs, right, it's a slightly, you know, there's a whole series of things, and those three just about came top. The Conservatives' main message, and their poll's much simpler, which might be the right thing, the economy and the management of it to reduce the deficit, because Labour hadn't fixed the roof when the sun was shining, and then, actually quite low for once, immigration, which is one they can always pull. So here's a different story for you, just to get you going, about what might be possible. This isn't about a prediction, because anything can happen. We could easily find in a month's time that we've actually voted to leave the EU. We could find that there isn't going to be a second referendum. That's it, we really are leaving. We could find a snap general election because Cameron has to resign. I will happily eat a small piece of paper if he doesn't. And if we were to leave the EU, my suspicion is that the amount we'd have to raise interest by to defend the pound on the run on the pound would be so high that the economic catastrophe would be a game changer, possibly making the country more equal than it has been for decades. But I don't believe my predictions enough to go on that. Possibly ending the Conservative Party as a party. All parties do end eventually. But I'm a Remain voter. And I, as I say, I don't believe in predictions. But let me, I've got 10 minutes left, try and tell you a different potential story about where you might get with voting. Okay. It's accepted wisdom that for a party to be elected under our current first-past-the-post system, it has to appeal to swing voters. I don't know, maybe I could... Are any of you a swing voter who moves, you know, elections between Conservatives and Labour? One election you vote Labour, the other Conservative. Just one day, because a swing voter will identify themselves to me, and I can study them. But apparently there are swing voters that vote Tory and Labour, don't waste their time with the other parties. And that matter in marginal seats. Now, unfortunately, we don't have a marginal seat within this county, so none of you actually matter. You know, occasionally Oxford West can go between the two parties that are in coalition, but nothing else ever happens here. But as a result of this accepted wisdom that what matters is swing voters, parties have to vie over the central ground. And because of this, in recent decades, a large set of the electorate, that's you, have come to see little to choose between the main parties, because they've looked similar. You also believe that you can't trust politicians, because as they begin to tell you the same things, you know, Cameron hugs a husky because he really cares. Labour says it's going to be tough on the causes of crime because it wants to pretend to be like the Conservatives. The more and more they do that, the less you trust them. Politicians are clearly motivated to maximise their votes rather than being driven by conviction. This is obvious to voters, and it turns people away from parties and candidates, which is one reason why so many people don't vote. Tariq Ali, who used to be of this city, wrote in the LRB recently that during the Brown-Blair period, the Labour Party unlearned social democracy of the Crossland variety, no matter anything resembling the classic model of early socialism. Corbyn, and this is what I'm getting on to, is Corbyn knows it's vital that the party relearns social democracy. Nothing that exciting. If Corbyn was that exciting, he wouldn't have stayed in the Labour Party. But the party needs to relearn social democracy. It once seemed a hopeless task. Now, says Tariq, they might have a chance. Now, Tony Crossland was elected the Labour MP in 1950. In 1950, the turnout in the general election was 84%. By 97, it was just 71%. It fell to 59% in 2001, crept up in 2015 because it was a bit close to 66%. But even that, in the last general election, only 24% of the electorate voted Conservatives. Just 24% of the electorate. And remember, the electorate is for everybody who could vote. Millions of people don't register to vote. I won't ask you, I will make sure I stop on time to get to. The country you have to go to find somewhere more corrupt than others is Colombia. You can become president of Colombia on 18%. But anyway, we have a majority Conservative government with 24% electorate. Only 20% voted Labour, 22% for other parties, 34% of people didn't vote. Some 7.5 million eligible adults were not registered to vote. And this was a marginal election where it was worth registering. We've made registering harder. More people are renting privately, more have to move more frequently. We make you register individually. And of course, there are loads and loads of human beings who we don't see as human beings, not quite as human as we are, who even if they want to register to vote, say over an issue that might really matter to them, like whether we're going to leave Europe or not, because they're not British or Commonwealth citizens, for some reason the fact that they're living here means that they're not eligible to be involved in our most serious politics. The true proportions of all adults living in the UK who voted for either Labour or Conservatives in general election in May 2015 was far, far less than 40%. It may be as low as a third if you were to include everybody, the prisoners as well, who are not allowed to vote. Less than a third of adults voting for your two main parties. It's a remarkable state to get into. In 1950, only a quarter of the electorate didn't vote for either the Conservatives or Labour, including not voting at all. Just a quarter. Almost everybody who could register to vote was registered in 1950. We had identity cards still in 1950. Now a majority, 50%, 56% of the electorate do not give the main two parties their vote. There are a lot of votes out there for the taking. If Labour is going to increase its share of the vote, it needs to target people who vote for minor parties, people who've given up voting at all, or given up registering to vote. And that includes lots and lots of potential new voters who are turning 18 since 2015. Half of whom will have the biggest debt we've ever given a young person in their life because they've gone to university. Currently it's 3 years' worth if you've got the £9,000 a year, which equates to £56,000 on average to pay back, £100,000 if you're successful. Which might explain why working class men in an average area, less than 10% are going to university now. Because a white working class man from an average area, you know, is looking at a salary which means that they would have to pay back. What I think the Labour Party needs to do and other progressive parties need to do is to look to that group of people who currently do not vote. You can look to the Scottish elections to see what happens when you actually give people a choice that might matter. You can get turnout to around about 84%, I think the highest it's ever been. Anybody know the turnout in Austria today? Had any of you heard of Mr. Belen before he became... I know, it's a wonderful name, isn't it? That's what I like about Europe, with the names. No, they haven't bothered to report anything about him at all, had they? Before he became president. The Conservatives are frightened of this. What the Conservatives want is a pliant new Labour opposition, which can win power every 10 or 15 years, preferably for just 5 years. Turn a few things down slightly. It's like turning the gas down on privatisation a little bit. But not alter the course of the direction that we've been going into since 1979. If you really believe in the project since 79, your worst fear is a government that might undo it all, that might cancel PFI, that might say this isn't possible, that might re-nationalise the railways, that might get rid of that thing, the only thing that keeps you alive, which is Trident. If we didn't have Trident, we'd be dead tomorrow. You know, it's there. Don't you understand how important Trident is? You know, how on earth did they manage to survive in Germany and the Netherlands and Sweden and Portugal and everywhere else but France, Europe? Why did Sadiq Khan win the election in London? Was it because he was the Muslim son of a bus driver? Was that the reason? Or was it because all the mayors won, the Labour mayors won, and because the Labour vote actually did remarkably well, apart from in Scotland, where it is still New Labour? Labour needs to stop wasting effort pretending it wouldn't work with other parties in a coalition. It's obviously a lie, so don't bother lying. Labour needs to work out that it has got most in common with the Green Party and actually begin to talk to them. It's already happening. John Macdonald is saying that PR should be in the manifesto. The leader who's stepping down of the Greens basically says, if you put PR in the manifesto, I'll do whatever you want, for obvious good reasons. On the way to that, my suggestion is that Labour identify 10 seats, 5 of which are winnable. The obvious one is Brighton. There's one in the west of Bristol, one in Norwich, one in the middle of London, probably near Holborn, and one in either York or Liverpool, depending on which Labour MP you don't like, who's there. This all becomes possible if the seats get redrawn, by the way. If you keep it quiet, if you're of my political disposition, seats being redrawn is an amazing thing. When the seats are redrawn, and they're reduced to 600, every candidate has to be reselected. But also, no seat belongs to anybody. So at that point, you can identify these 5 seats and quietly walk away from them if you're Labour. You can identify another 5, but the Greens come second in the 5 seats. You've never heard of these, have you? Because they're all down in the southwest of England, and they come a long way second to the Conservatives. And then all the Greens, and I'm sure there are Greens in the room with Oxfordshire, and you're lovely people, stop campaigning in Oxfordshire and head off for 2 weeks, you know, to Bristol or Norwich or Brighton, and get 5 Green MPs into the House of Commons. And meanwhile, this may sound fantasy to you, it happened in Chester. In the city of Chester, in May 2015, the Greens didn't stand, and Labour won by less than 100 votes. Right, but you're not allowed to say that happened because of tribalism. Clever Conservatives fear Corbyn and they fear the Greens and Labour working together. Some reasons to be optimistic this kind of thing is possible. Things are changing. The future is always different. Big change is inevitable. It happens. We make a mistake when we think it's not going to change very much. The UK is changing into a multi-party system. It's becoming more European. The best evidence we're becoming more European is UKIP. Every decent large European country has a bunch of people who are slightly obnoxious who form a party of that kind. It means you're becoming more European. In the past, we had them hidden within our Conservative Party. which is why the National Front collapsed in 1979 when Margaret Thatcher won. You need to fundraise. Trade unions aren't going to provide huge amounts of funding. The way Obama got funding was crowdsourcing. And if you're going to fundraise in the future, the opposition is a few rich donors who have strange reasons why they really want the world to be their way. If you're going to go against rich donors, you need crowdsourcing. And the only way you're going to fundraise from crowdsourcing is if you're offering something that's exciting enough for somebody like me to go, okay, I'll press the button and give 20 or 40 or 60 pounds. Now, it doesn't have to be Corbyn, but it has to be interesting. And if Corbyn can even be slightly interesting, just think what might be possible with somebody else from the Labour Party of his variety. I should say, I'm not a Labour Party member. It's just numerically where the most likely future is. You win seats still by having people knocking on doors, so you need campaigning. You won't get people campaigning unless they see a reason for campaigning. This question of honesty also really matters. Politicians are the least trusted profession. The trust in politicians has dropped massively in the last 30 years. Chris Mullen, you remember Chris Mullen being lauded for the fact that he only claimed for a black and white TV licence? Yeah. I always wonder why he bothered to claim for a black and white TV licence. You know, he was paid enough, he could have paid a TV licence himself. Do you know which MP claimed for less than Chris Mullen? Jeremy Corbyn. Lowest expenses. Hasn't been used. He also overpays his taxes. He's also a reluctant leader. Whereas if you looked at David and Ed Miliband, they certainly weren't reluctant to try and lead. Tony Blair and Gordon Brown were not reluctant to try and lead. David Cameron and Boris Johnson are not reluctant to try and lead. They got a thirst for power. Jeremy had to be persuaded to stand. Now, you might think that's a bad thing, because what we really need are strong leaders. The view that you need strong leaders is one that grows in a country that's very divided. Clement Attlee was not a strong leader. Had lots of strong politicians in his cabinet, but Clement Attlee was not a strong leader, and he got us the NHS, and he got us Social Security, and he bedded in the schools that we got a few years earlier. Harold Wilson was not a particularly strong leader. He's a fairly quiet-spoken bloke from near Huddersfield who came down here and did a bit of history and statistics. Failed to get a job as a school teacher. Had to work for a bloke called Beveridge as a researcher. But he had an Iron Bevan and a Barbara Castle. Sorry, an Iron Bevan was Attlee. Single charismatic leaders like Margaret Thatcher and Tony Blair are bad news. They're dangerous. Corbyn's not in it for the money. Really isn't. Tony Blair's worth £60 million now, and as much as £200,000 for a single speaking engagement. If you're trying to get people interested in politics again, having a party where your leader generally isn't selfishly in it for the money, yeah, could be seen as an advantage. Or if he becomes ill, which is not impossible given the age, replacing by somebody of a similar character. So make it not about the individual, but about the idea of the person. Not selfish, not greedy, not in it for yourself. That's the kind of person you want. You want somebody who appears to be listening. Somebody who will listen to junior doctors rather than simply tell them off. You want somebody who may appear to learn from their mistakes. You want somebody who's not in awe of the United States of America. Otherwise, you're constantly telling people the same old story. Gordon Brown used to go every summer to the USA. You want somebody who's able to form alliances, because with first-past-the-post politics, you're going to have to form alliances, and you're going to have to talk to the Scottish National Party, because they're not going to go away anytime soon. And that requires not being too macho. You're going to have to work with Plaid Cymru. You might have to work with some Liberals as well. And you've certainly got to work with the Greens. So why is the Parliamentary Labour Party or small group in the Parliamentary Labour Party opposing Corbyn? I've got one quote from an old Labour advisor who works in this university. If their strategy, this is the Parliamentary Labour Party, small group, is so obviously misguided, why do anti-Corbynisters persist? Mm-hmm. One reason may be human nature. They hate Corbyn, and they find it difficult to bite their tongue. The clever Conservatives have a hope that the anti-Corbyn minority will win. What they need is a Labour Party that gains office every 10 or 15 years and doesn't upset their project. A Labour Party heading in a different direction with a mass membership is their worst nightmare. The Conservatives want opposition parties to fight amongst themselves, not a Labour Party that might even consider openly showing tolerance to Greens, the SNP, Plaid Cymru and some Liberals, and then bringing in a PR system, which is what Wales has got, London has got, Scotland has got, and the rest of the entire continent has got, apart from us, which means you can no longer win with the support of a tiny minority of people who happen to hold property, which is what we currently have. So where's the criticism of Corbyn? Very recent, last week, opinion piece in New Yorker summed up Corbyn's wider appeal, but also the criticism. He had to answer a question about refugees. Corbyn didn't need to think. They're all human beings, just like you and me, he said. In a different set of circumstances, we could all be in those refugee camps. When he speaks simply and off the cuff, Corbyn can have the moral clarity of a priest. The room broke out into loud applause. And that's his problem. He actually says what he believes, that other people are human beings, that we should treat them decently. And that isn't the way, traditionally, of winning elections. But it is the way of appearing to be something different and new. So if you want to say what matters most is that we've chosen to run our health service down to the level that the Italians and the Greeks are forced to run their health service down, what matters is that we've cut spending on schools for children aged 16 and 17 while pretending that the budget is ring-fenced. So the gap between the amount of money being spent on state school sixth formers and sixth formers in private school is now wider than it has ever been in our history. If you want to say, yes, we've got 2 million more jobs, but they're not jobs that people are particularly happy to have. They involve precarity, zero-hours contracts, very low wages, no career, no structure, and all your income goes on rent anyway. If you want a politician who's actually going to complain about the things that people complain about the fact that people cannot start families, well, a politician whose aim is not to try to maximise house prices as high as they can get them, which is what the aim of the Conservative Party has been since 2010. Whatever can we do to get house prices in London and Oxford going up as high as possible? Which isn't in the interest of most people. And then, if you want to start to talk about what actually makes people happier and have greater well-being, which is a sense of security that if you get ill, all those around you get ill, they'll be looked after. And if you work hard enough and try, but not like some workaholic idiot, you will be able to have a comfortable life. And that we respect other people around you, and we do not respect people looking down at others for some reason that makes no sense. If you can build a positive idea forward, what might be possible? It is a very long time between now, 2016 and 2020. I personally will be surprised if both John McDonald and Jeremy Corbyn, health-wise, are still there in 2020. Just because I'm one of these slightly callous people who looks at statistics and age and stress. Because they are working 6.5 days a week. And like David Cameron, who works about 4 days a week, if you count it up carefully. But it isn't just about them. It's about hundreds of thousands of people who've joined a party that I'm not even a member of. It's about polls which have gone against expectations. It's again about by-elections like Oldham, which have gone against expectations. And it's about a new intake of young MPs, including in the SNP, but mainly in Labour, in the House of Commons, who are of the same mind, but just keep their voices quiet. And all the time they're becoming shadow ministers. All the time they are becoming something of the future. And what's left of the old Labour Party, the old Blairite Labour Party, is heading off for jobs to be mayors of Manchester or some other exit route out of it. And the change is slow and almost imperceptible. But it's happening. I don't know how you turn it into something a bit more exciting. You know, because the problem is, if you are in a situation which isn't good, talking about just making it a bit better is not the most exciting thing on the planet, but it is more realistic. Nobody's going to give this country a new nirvana in the next 10 or 15 years' time. Some people might tell you, if you vote to leave now, Britain will be great again and will be the most powerful trading nation on the planet by the time you're drawing your pension. And you could choose to believe them. The alternative of making things better is a much less exciting proposition, because things are so bad compared to what is normal on this continent. In the rest of this continent, almost everybody can send their child to school for free and not think they're disadvantaging them from doing this. They can expect a better quality of healthcare and a longer life expectancy. They can expect to be asking their doctor for fewer antidepressants. They can expect, if they're made redundant, to get far, far better benefits than us. The idea there's benefit tourism to this country is just laughable when you look at the benefits elsewhere. And their future young generation is not going to be in a debt, not just the university debts, but paying for the PFI, paying for the schools, everything else we've auctioned off. I can't find a way of, and in the end of this book I don't have it, a way of saying what a wonderful, bright new future you could have. But you could certainly find a way of saying you don't have to have a future as bad as this. And the way the book ends, and it doesn't include all this stuff about Corbyn, I just put it in to try to make this more interesting for questions. The way the book ends is it looks at a set of old people in the United States and what they were asked about their biggest regrets in life, the mistakes they'd made. And that's always interesting to do. We don't do enough of it. And it involves things such as staying with the wrong person, so relationships matter. Not telling the person you really liked them. So if you're worrying about that, now's the time to do it. but also worrying too much about short-term gain, thinking it really mattered when in hindsight it didn't. And lastly, and it really shook me actually when I read this one, paying such high fees for their university education that wasn't worth it at all. They've had it in America for so long that there are even old people who can now tell you what a mistake that was. So, that's my half an hour to try to get you going. Hopefully it's made you think of some things, and you want to tell me why I'm completely naive or why I'm too downbeat or too upbeat. So let's just start. Go on.
Just quickly, since you said, I think fairly, that Corbyn won't live forever, and you described fairly precisely what would be an ideal or a predicted successor. You got any names in mind?
Oh, give you one. I quite like Louise Haig, who nobody's heard of, is an MP for Sheffield Heeley. But she's not a name that's mentioned. But remember, nobody was mentioning young Tony Blair's name, you know, when he became MP for Sedgefield in 83. And Louise only became MP last year. But so not Clive. But it could be Clive. It could be any of them. The point of this is that they don't matter. We've come to think that individuals are particularly important. When progressive politics does well, you have half a dozen people, like Barbara Castle. You know, you have half a dozen capable people, like Crosland. Not the single charismatic leader is a thing of right, you know, including the far right. You know, the single dominant strong person you can look up to and respect, who will make their cabinet cower because they might hit them with a handbag. That doesn't happen in progressive politics. Progressive politics is a messy coalition of trying to agree with people and not thinking that in your own head you're all powerful and all knowing.
Perhaps I should have said names rather than name then.
Yeah, should be names. But have a look at the other nice thing about the new intake is they don't get the housing allowances because we've changed the system. So they're actually having to rent at London prices. And if you want a way to teach young MPs about the world, so their salary's not bad, it's what, 67? But actually having to pay London rent at 67, and they're never going to get the property. So unlike, I mean, he's dead now, but you know, Michael Meacher ended up with 11 flats. They're never going to be in that situation unless they do dodgy, corrupt deals to, you know, do questions in Parliament for business. And this is what I mean by the accretion of chances. Every year that goes past, old MPs who are now landlords retire and leave. New ones have paid another year of rent to a landlord as an MP and don't feel that well off. And might actually be worrying about how some of them can have a family. You know, and that's what you need. You need your members of Parliament to be slightly connected with the population. And we lost that because when the wages of MPs didn't go up with Thatcher, she gave them these incredible housing allowances and the way of swapping housing that meant that on the back of an inflating London housing market, you could become a very rich individual. Far richer than your salary actually would ever have meant. I think that's very positive for the future.
So you're saying, or you said, that the future of politics or canvassing is still on doorsteps, but one of the problems with people registering to vote is that they're moving around a lot.
Yeah.
And the sense I get is that people's identity is now tied, you know, rightly or wrongly, to their presence online.
Yeah.
And that possibly the future of voting, although it's, you know, not necessarily, it's got its own problems, should be online and people tied to people's identity in that way.
Yeah.
Do you think that's a potential feature? Do you think that's going to get younger people involved in elections in a way that they just wouldn't through being caught on the doorstep?
I don't know. There are studies of this. And in the old days, actually one lecturer did this. So I shouldn't reveal it. Tony Blair always used to say he could win a seat with 200 people, which is actually quite a lot to ask for, 200 knocking up. I watched Bristol West go from being Labour of third to winning it in 97 when William Wardgrave lost it, and that was 200 people. The studies to date say knocking up still matters, which can include in Sheffield Central knocking up and saying, I won't report the smell of what you're growing in your house if you vote. work for Labour. Beat the Liberal doing that one. I'm not a party member, I just find this kind of thing fascinating. And most people who knock up are not party members. They get involved the last few weeks. In theory, the online stuff should begin to matter more, but I don't think there's a substitute that's as affected as the reminder of some poor sod has gone out of their way and has knocked on the door to make you think just to vote. Because the biggest problem is people not voting. And you something needs to make you think, I'm going to bother to vote. And somebody knocking on your door, I think, makes that more likely. The European referendum is very useful for getting people to register to vote. You know, it's looking not too, it could be fairly close. If people can't be bothered to register to vote for this, the tragedy is that they're going to use the electoral roll of December last year to redraw the boundaries. If they'd waited to the electoral roll we have now, then Oxfordshire would get a seventh parliamentary constituency. If we get a seventh constituency in Oxfordshire, we've got six at the moment, I don't think there's any way of putting a seventh one in and you don't get two Labour seats. Because Andrew Smith gets over 50% of the vote. It's like a Durham Pitt Village in Oxford East. I mean, it's quite remarkable. you know, so it's a ridiculously safe Labour seat. Sorry for the long answer. It's more the other thing which does matter is people talking to their friends. So the it used to be called Over the Garden Fence. One of the very big influences on people's votes and assumptions of what's possible is what other people say. You don't want to appear to look stupid. So you don't want to say, actually, Corbyn doesn't look bad to me, because it's not just the press telling you he's mad and the BBC telling you he's mad and the Guardian refusing to print a single one of my articles on him, because they really hate him more than anything else. It's other people. And as soon as other people sort of say to you, you know, a Green can become president of Austria, it'll be possible for the Austrians to vote in, you know, a really radical politician as their president. And you need people saying that to you. Now, the fact it's true also helps. But it doesn't actually matter if it's true or not. You know, it's this confirmation. And, you know, if I gave a talk like this, and you were all very hostile to me, and I've been fairly, I think, fairly radical even for an Oxford lefty audience in Blackwell's bookshop, you know, I would adjust my views on how you behave to me, and you adjust your views slightly on what I've said, and we just do that in our lives constantly. That happened in Scotland. I spent 2 weeks before the referendum in Glasgow. I was sure it was going to go independent. Glasgow did. And the question I asked people again and again, after I stopped being blown away by what appeared to be happening, was, how many people do you now know and talk to? And everybody I talked to, admittedly in pubs, but everybody I talked to said, the number I know has doubled. I know more people now. So it had changed people's social circles. But that vote became large and became big because of word of mouth. Which was not reported south of the border, which is partly why it was a shock, which is why all those Labour politicians had to go up on the train of shame to try and save it.
Thanks for your talk. And I noticed in the beginning you were talking about what makes people happy and unhappy, and quite a few of those were kind of small-scale things, perhaps individual things. And then the second half of your talk, you pointed out what you think is the appeal of Corbyn has to do with preferences about the collective, or bigger scale preferences about fairness and structure of society. Could you possibly expand a bit more about what the former sheds on the light of the latter?
So I used quite a lot of work by social scientist from there called Benjamin Radcliffe, who's shown that we all vary individually in terms of our happiness. You know, some of you are happier people, some of you, you know you're actually, you know, more glass half empty. But what he showed is that the variation between countries is bigger than the variation within countries. And the amazing thing, and it's still hard to believe if you know quite a lot of Finns, but the amazing thing is that past the superficial level of... The superficial happiness question is, ask you, how happy are you on a scale from 10? And you tell me 7. And that's because we're in the United Kingdom. If it was USA, you'd say 8. If you're in a more normal country, you'd say 5, because you have some idea about averages, then it makes more sense to say 5. If you ask the standard depression questions, the Finns do better than we do. We're more depressed than the Finns. And the question is, why? And the argument is that the Finns are taxing, but also spending very carefully, about 57% of their GDP. It's one of the highest proportions in Europe. They're spending the money on producing the best schools in the world. So you don't have to worry about where you live. Try and imagine it, if you've got kids. Not worrying about what house you live in which area of town. Well, we're in Oxford. Okay? You can save, I don't know, £2.3 million by not living on that street near Summertown and going down to a nice little terrace in Littlemore, because the schools aren't any different, right? Or we have a transport system that means that you can use the train or the tram to come into work from your nice little satellite town that you live on the edge of the country park that you go cycling in Oxfordshire, that county where the parks are open to everybody, so we can all enjoy the countryside. I mean, so you go through the macro differences and think about it from people's everyday personal experiences. Health is the easiest. Yeah. people are made upset by ill health. If you fund your health system so that it doesn't have 4-hour waits on trolleys, so people are not waiting 3 weeks or 4 weeks or 5 weeks for an operation, then the level of angst you're going to get about illness will be much lower. But I use about 10 economists and social policy people at the start of the book and just repeat their claims. And what's been interesting in the last 10 years is other people are finding this, and it's not the usual suspects. It's economists.
Can I ask a follow-up? I suppose I'm interested in whether those Finns have a boost to their happiness out of a sense of security in the equalities. So do they feel comfortable because they know it's kind of simple enough of a structure to grasp? Or is it just this individual thing about how their kid's going to be faring? The reason I'm interested is it might link through to these qualities of leaders in the parties. And this thing you mentioned about the stiff upper lip, you know, to what extent should Labour figures be trying to seek an accommodation with the kind of stoical or puritanical elements in our society, as well as the ones connected with happiness maximisation?
It's what you're on the way. I mean, in other countries they worry less about leaders because they have so many more parties. It's normal to have at least 8 parties under PR. So you can't get that obsessed about leaders because, you know, you'd have so many individuals you'd have to actually worry about. You know, are they that odd? This is cross-sectional. So it's what we don't have is data over a long length of time saying, and it's almost, well, we don't have it, so we can't speculate on what's happened over that period. We do have lots of current data about people being diagnosed as having anxiety and depression, and about the number of antidepressants being purchased. And that really suggests problems in the USA and problems in the UK, which suggests we're not getting things right. But you may not notice what it is that's made you worry more or made you eat more. You know, as I said at the beginning, you know, we're the fattest country in Europe. At least we know that now. But we worry about, are we fat because Public Health England's advice hasn't been good? I mean, did any of you know what Public Health England's advice was and what you're supposed to eat? Yeah. The reason we're fat is the Nick Griffin reason. Nick was always doing this, and I can speak as a man of not a dissimilar size to Nick. We snack nervously on food, and we're more worried about things, and we eat more because it comforts us. But we also have a food industry that we don't regulate because we don't believe in regulating it. So there's more advertising. And you can look across Europe and you can actually measure the wastes, and people tend to get thinner in the countries with better regulation. But the thinnest of all are in Japan, which is the most equal society, where your outcomes in life are least determined by who your parents are. And the fattest in the rich world is the United States. There's a connection between these things that isn't about the dietary advice given out by your public health body. Let's go.
I was questioning about proportional representation. I'm a British, I'm Dutch. I'm stunned, actually, to live here now for almost 20 years, that we still, here in England, we and UK, are still taking this for granted. A system which, to me, is incredibly archaic. I know a couple of years ago we had a referendum. Will it ever change? This is what I wonder.
Well, I mean, they've still got it in America over the presidential election, and you know, and there they only get 2 parties. Because you get more unequal, you tend to get less choice. The referendum was a muck-up. You know, Labour really should have gone for it, and will be kicking itself now. If PR is put in a Labour manifesto, then you don't need a referendum. If Labour form a majority government with other parties, they can introduce PR without a referendum. If it's in a manifesto, you don't need a referendum. The Shadow Chancellor said it'll be in the manifesto. Eventually we'll get PR, or become a dictatorship. I mean, can't carry on with this system. And once you've got PR, things change. You know, it's not utopia, as you know, from the Netherlands, right? And you do, and it gives a platform for extreme far right people, and we'd have 50 UKIP people here. But you can also cut up your big parties. So you can have two or three Labour parties, and I can have my own little one that I like. Yeah. And I know the one in Greece that I like and the one in other countries.
We've got two in Holland. We've got the Socialist Party and the Labour Party. And they have different appeal to different people.
That's it.
But I think that the problem of the we are much more, for us it's quite normal to have coalitions.
Yeah. But the idea of actually voting for the person you believe in, you know, what I find really funny is we criticise the EU for being undemocratic. Quite. Well, we have this. Go on.
It's fine.
Go on at the front.
I was interested in your comment about the Nordic states. You're saying how they have, you know, these welfare regimes where they provide, say, these equal education services. But something that strikes me as also possibly quite different in those countries is people's attitudes towards welfare states in the first place. So you spoke in your talk about if you can distinguish between, say, supply and demand side of politics. You focus quite a lot on the supply side of things, what the politicians are doing. But how would you suggest, you know, we can improve progressive politics from a demand side? Is it about the media? Or can those of us who don't want to sign up to a particular party at this point do to change that conversation?
Yeah, I don't like signing up to parties, so I don't belong to one. We're talking and saying, and when it feels uncomfortable, just push yourself slightly in the situation you wouldn't normally say something. It's not just talking to other people. If you want to write a letter, write a letter. If you want to do something else. Because the vast majority of people do almost nothing, anything you do is beneficial. I, for years, have supported the 20 mile an hour campaign. Which I just learned the other day, they have 7 miles an hour in Barcelona, but anyway. 20 miles an hour is about getting the speed of your roads down to 20 miles an hour. We've got it in Oxford, most of Oxford. It doesn't sound very radical, but it's actually about saying that the freedoms of a few, normally men, to drive at 30 past schools are not worth the freedoms of everybody else not to have to suffer what they're doing. And the same principles of 20 mile an hour can be extended to almost everything in your economy. So things that seem a bit pedestrian, I think are very worthwhile. Also, people change by the system. I'm sure that the Norwegians 60 years ago were not the same kind of people that they are now. They are vocal in their support for what they have, and quite angry. I've been told off in Norway for saying how good life is in Norway, quoting social statistics around the world and saying you're the best at this, and people say you shouldn't say that because we could be so much better.
Fits in with what you were saying earlier about how people adjust to their circumstances.
Whereas we've adjusted to this, we think this is normal. In the States, you can't ask to do a basic poverty survey. In the States, the poverty survey is one where we ask you all, should all children in Britain be able to have two pairs of shoes, not just one? Should they be able to have a warm winter coat? Should they get two meals a day or three meals a day? Those kind of questions. No poverty survey like that. It's been asked all over Europe, including in Britain. It's not asked in the States because too many people would say they shouldn't get it if their parents don't work hard enough to get it for them. Otherwise, they don't deserve it. The country you grow in changes you as a human being. Take one at the back, and there's one at the front, and I'll stop. Yep, that's you.
In terms of happiness, I was wondering about globalisation, and you might have a phone in your pocket that's made in a Chinese factory that has kind of suicide nets around it, because the workers probably aren't very happy. Or you have a shirt made in a sort of Bangladeshi factory, and I think there's a... If you did have a sort of utopian government, I wonder whether you would go back to... You're talking about the past. Would you go back to capital controls and import duties, sort of, in order to make your country more happy? You either have to say there are people in third world countries who are not very happy to give us the lifestyle that we want, or do you almost take the attitude that people aren't particularly valuable, there's a lot where they came from? Not much, I think, is said about globalisation.
No. Well, I mean, this is a big problem for the Labour Party. George Orwell was the person who always said that the Labour Party in 1945 didn't realise they could get a welfare state because of the income from the empire and the rest made it possible. I don't think you need capital controls or anything, because all I'm talking about is trying to move towards being like the Netherlands, and the Netherlands doesn't have capital controls. You know, this isn't particularly radical. This is stopping being one of the least progressive countries in Western Europe, moving towards the middle. I mean, it's a pretty pathetic aim. If you look at happiness worldwide, it's very interesting, because apart from those workers in that factory in China, you don't find absolutely depressing levels of unhappiness in many poorer places. Or put it the other way, you don't find ecstatic happiness here. And I mean, just to slightly facetious, but I was involved in trying to get a net slung in this country. We tried to get a net slung under the Avon Suspension Bridge, because so many people jump off the Avon Suspension Bridge. And we were stopped at the last minute. I worked at University of Bristol. We were stopped from having a net put under the bridge by Avon Fire Brigade, who had had to fish people out of it, on the grounds that they were funded to look after the people of Avon, and most people who jumped off the bridge had a one-way ticket from somewhere else. And that's the kind of individualistic country we've become, where a budget officer in a fire brigade will stop you putting a net under a bridge because of their allocation formula. So there's still no net under the Avon Suspension Bridge, whereas at least there are nets on the edge of that factory. Now, you don't want anybody to feel they want to jump, but we're not that great here.
Thank you. So in the beginning of your talk, you spoke about what a better politics would look like, and the second half of your talk, you spoke about what should Labour do in order to win elections. So I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about how easy it would be to get Labour to undertake this better politics that you talk about, whether it would come automatically or whether there are certain obstacles that we should consider.
Most things in the book are very near to things that they are doing or willing to do. 80% of it, I'd say, would be. You know, and it was in Miliband's programme. You know, Miliband said cut down student loans to £6,000, which is the way to begin to make them lower, increase tenancies to 3 years, so you've got some security. So half the book was already in that political party's manifesto. The more radical things would be difficult. In fact, I don't think my editor's here, so I can tell you. he cut the most radical 10,000 words out to make it more reasonable. But it included a suggestion that we do... The most likely way you'd die in this country between the age of 5 and 25 is you're going to be hit by a car. It's the biggest killer. 6,000 children die a year in Britain. It's the highest proportion, the highest absolute number in Europe. In other countries in Europe, speeding fines are proportional to income. A man drove his Ferrari through a village in Switzerland, 85 miles an hour, was fined €185,000. He drove it 3 times through, didn't hit anybody. Somebody in Finland fined €80,000. Favourite one is somebody in Germany. Footballer drove under the influence of drugs, didn't hit anybody, €500,000 fine. Right? Makes you think about not doing it again. Right? It's a really obvious thing to do. Now that's the kind of thing I could see Labour not putting in its manifesto, you know, even though it is so obvious that this is the most dangerous thing that most of us will ever do, is when we speed in a car. The idea of making fines proportional to income, you can still pay them. It's calculated so you can pay it. But if you move a country towards being more reasonable, then one day that is what we'll do. And one day the national speed limit will be down to 20 miles an hour. And one day we'll put barriers along the middle of country roads. I drove back from Cheltenham today. I had a meeting this morning on the A40. And because I do road traffic statistics, all the time on the A40, when lorries are coming towards me, I was thinking about the fact they have barriers in the middle of those roads in Sweden. You know, there were 50 times I could have had a head-on collision just today. But we don't think about it. You get used to it. It's normal. A cyclist was killed last week at the Wolvercote roundabout. It's normal, it happens. It doesn't happen in other countries as often. And that's the better politics side of it. It is possible to reduce grief and misery and increase happiness dramatically just by altering things that only politicians can alter. Because you individually cannot alter how the Wolvercote roundabout has been set up. And you cannot alter the Oxford housing market that means that you might have to cycle through that roundabout every day to get to work. That's what we need politicians for. There's no other way of doing it. I've gone past 8 o'clock. Thank you very much for your attention. Thank you.
Thank you so much for a really interesting and informative and kind of thought-promoting talk. If you guys would like to read more about Danny's findings, the copies of the book are on sale here, and we will have a talk link just over there where you can pay. And I'm sure Danny would be more than happy to sign copies if anyone would like to have a copy dedicated. Thank you all for coming. We have a very active events programme, so if you'd like to know more about what we've got coming up, please do speak to a member of staff. Otherwise, thank you again, Danny, for a great talk, and thank you for coming.
Thank you.